Hi, my name's Pete Banton, and I'm the co-founder of the Awaken Life Project here in Portugal. And I'd like to welcome you to this new podcast, which is named after my recently released first book called The Fire of the Heart. In this podcast, I'm going to be exploring the nature of an authentic spiritual awakening and its potential implications in these tipping point times we are living through together. I hope that you will find these podcasts illuminating and provocative, and most of all, I hope that they'll ignite a big and potentially all-consuming fire in your heart.
And I think, because as you said, you know, back in the days when there were mammoths around and saber-toothed tigers, you know, we had to be in our masculine dominance or we would get eaten, you know, wouldn't survive.
And then to be in it all the time.
Yeah, but then also, you know, today, most men most progressive men or couples, you know, we're also going beyond those more traditional roles of men are in the position of being the provider, you know, women at home with the kids, you know, the men, yep, are the ones who are always driving the car, you know. Yep. And so do you find, because I think it's really interesting, it just makes a lot of sense what you're saying, and it also resonates with what we're discovering in our collective, that there's something about these deep primal, you know, like, you know, when we do certain activities on our retreats just to really get in touch with that, you know, raw masculine haka, you know.
Yeah,
you know, like last retreat we went go-karting, you know, and it was right, super competitive, you know, and we do a tug of war every year, you know, and Portugal versus the rest of the world, and the rest of the world's winning so far. But then normally, you know, our regular meetings are more, you know, in a circle, you know, we do some meditation at the beginning and, you know, an inquiry and a lot of sharing in that way. But the retreats, you know, when we have a longer time together, a big part of it is really inhabiting this raw masculine, you know, warrior spirit, you know, and it's just so enlivening, you know, it's so ecstatic, you know, to allow, when men allow themselves to be that which is so taboo, you know, in post. Exactly. And for many men, it's like, it's a revelation. It's like getting in touch with a kind of a long lost, as you say, instinct that has been, yeah, buried and denied, you know, their whole lives. And, but I think what an interesting challenge in terms of, like you said, you know, it's one thing to inhabit that, like in a retreat situation, or in the bedroom, you know, as you were saying, you know, David Dada often speaks to. But to really, you know, become to become the continuum, if you like, the current of one's disposition, in a time when you know, we're not necessarily inhabiting those traditional roles in the same way, you know, that maybe the woman's earning more money, going out to work, maybe you know, she's a lot better driver than you are, you know, my wife, but a lot better driver. And so, you know, this is one of the reasons, I think, because obviously it's not about going back to those more traditional social roles necessarily, but it definitely, this is one way area I see of the collective as just being such a help, you know, because then men who are, it's like a constant, a place to tap into this male dominance, as you're talking about, this pure masculine strength and energy, you know, that's not necessarily going to be enacted day by day in the social roles and structures. Do you see what I'm getting at? So I'm curious, in terms of the work you're doing with the men there, if when men get in touch with this positive masculine dominance, does it often have a profound an effect on the architecture of their lives, you know?
Exactly. It's a great question. It does.
Yeah.
It does. Because, so there are multiple frequencies of dominance, as I would describe it. So you could be really dominant in your passion.
Yeah.
You could be dominant in your purpose. You could be dominant in your financial matters. You could be dominant in your physical health. Mm. You could be dominant with your woman. Now, what do I mean by that? You're just basically a master in those areas, okay? In the sense that you've achieved a really high degree of competency at the level that you need to be at.
Yeah.
So, you know, you could be financially dominant, and if you're hitting your financial goals, you kind of mastered it at that level. It may be six figures a year, whereas dominance for another guy might be a billion a year. But you're hitting your frequency of dominance. Okay, so in the academy, we specialize on dominance in relationship. That's the frequency of dominance that we're using. But that is arguably, I would argue it's probably the most important frequency. And I'll tell you why. Because if a man is dominant out in the world, but emasculated at home, not really dominant. I mean, he's got one dominance. He's got frequencies of dominance outside of the house. But if he comes home and his woman isn't wearing the pants, leading him, judging him, well, this man is going to be fundamentally living kind of an inverted reality.
Right.
Like, the most important person to him, his woman, is in the masculine pole where he should be.
Right.
That's a real problem, and it wreaks havoc systemically in his life. So even if he's awesome on the job as a CEO of a corporation, but he goes home and he's emasculated by his wife, well, that's going to affect his job performance. It's going to affect his happiness as a human being. Now, let's say he gets into the academy and he learns to reverse the inversion, and he takes the masculine pole with his woman. She takes the feminine pole. He becomes dominant in relationship. That will have a systemic effect on the rest of his life, because the primary inversion, which was eating away at his heart and soul, has been solved and is no longer undermining him energetically at most basic level. So there are men who were emasculated with their women, entered the academy, went through the program, and toward the end of it, and after they graduated, it's changed the way they show up at their jobs as CEOs, as managers, et cetera. Because what happens is, when you really learn that you can lead a woman, you have so much more faith that you can lead yourself as well. And a lot of men who come into the program, they even have, a lot of them, maybe most, have issues leading themselves.
Yeah.
And this is something that I point out to men at the beginning. I'm like, you need to know why you're on planet Earth. If you're lost and if you're aimless, you don't have clarity, focus about what you're doing with your life, you're not going to have that power.
Yeah, that's foundational.
Yeah, and she will feel that. She'll feel that you're lost. She'll feel that you are adrift and you don't know what you're doing with yourself. And that will make it nearly impossible, if not impossible, to actually submit. And we haven't used that word yet in this call, but that's a word that's even more controversial than the word dominance.
Very, very politically, spiritually incorrect.
Right. Hopefully you won't get canceled over that.
Hopefully this video won't get banned by YouTube. But yeah, even to suggest that that's something that an integral progressive woman might actually want.
Oh yeah,
that's rocket fuel. That's quite something.
Well, I'll tell you something, Peter. When women run a lot of masculine energy in their body minds, and they have to always be in control, according to this agenda, getting things done, doing, creates a stress inside them, a tension.
Yeah, and I see this over and over. It's one of the biggest challenges for women is
letting go of control.
Letting go of control, yeah, and this doing, you know, and the, you know, this identity around being having value through what they do.
Right. Exactly. Well said. Exactly. And so what we coach in the academy is your value as a woman doesn't come through what you're doing. It's coming through your feminine self-worth is the vulnerable sharing of feelings, needs, wants, desires, problems, and asking permission as well. So feminine self-worth is not some static entity, some abstract category. Right. It's actually an activity. Feminine self-worth is an activity. Just as masculine self-worth is an activity. It's not some static noun that has no act. Mm-hmm. So if a woman wants to feel her feminine self-worth, as we coach it in the academy, she'll use feminine communication. And in that act of using feminine communication, she's actually practicing submission to his leadership. Wow. And then guess what? All that tension and stress that she's been carrying around because she's had to control everything and do, it all dissolves. She feels her feminine radiance and she doesn't look back because wow. She realized all that fucking masculinization came from the Matrix.
Right.
And she's like tasting the reality of her feminine radiance. And she's like, you know what? I'm not going back to all that masculinization. I'm not going back to all that control, all of that doing. I'm not doing that anymore. And you've talked about how this affects men's lives. You ask about that. This affects women too. They end up transitioning out of masculine careers. They end up stop being the more masculine pole in the relationship. And then they find a dominant man who wants to lead all the time.
Right. Yeah, it's fascinating what you're saying. And have you also found that along with this feminine radiance, this authentic feminine radiance, there's a profound strength also that women get in touch with? Because when what I've seen in our community, because we also have a women's collective. So there's a women's collective as a men's collective, and been going roughly about the same length of time. And over time, this has become more and more powerful the last couple of years, especially. For example, the women do a retreat every year too, and then at the end of their retreat, they invited a group of us men down to meet with them. They wanted to thank us for serving the retreat. And when I saw this group of women, you know, many of whom I've known for many years, it was extraordinary because what was shining through them was this feminine radiance, this softness, this beauty, you know.
Yeah.
And at the same time, there was this strength, there's just this dignity. In other words, in that radiance, there was no need in the sense of, you know, we need you to be complete. You know, it's like they started to inhabit this authentic feminine radiance. And then what's one of the sort of edges of the visions, if you like, of what's possible between men and women that I'm interested in, and what you're saying speaks to it, is that when we get beyond this whole, you know, distorted, depolarized, postmodern mess, And we as men start to authentically inhabit that masculine pole down beyond the heart chakra, as you put it, and bring the lower three chakras online, you know, and women begin to do the same. Mm-hmm. Women become more feminine, more radiantly feminine. We become more, penetratingly masculine, or, you know, there's this kind of masculine potency and strength. And, you know, one way to language it is like, you know, we all have a masculine and a feminine. So they become, when it becomes integrated in men, I think that's, to me, is the startling and amazing discovery. Because I think in the postmodern understanding languaging, it's like, yeah, when a man integrates his feminine, he'll be more androgynous, you know. And the same with women, you know, and of course there's this whole insane, you know, movement in postmodern progressive culture that's basically about destroying gender polarity completely and literally destroying gender, you know, all this transgender nonsense, you know. And we can't, I read something on a news report I follow every day, you know, like some judge is something to do with the transgender issue. And she was asked, I think this woman, I don't remember her name, she's going for the Supreme Court.
That's right. Yeah.
She was asked, can you define what a woman is? And she said, no.
I'm not a biologist.
What the fuck? What's happening? It's just like insane. But anyway, coming back to
that's another area where you and I intersect. We intersect in a lot of areas because we're both aware of the cabal and their agendas.
You know, which,
that Supreme Court nominee is in that muck.
Exactly. And that's another area where maybe this will be another call, where, that the whole the whole integral, you know, meme is, you know, for the most part, completely unaware of and in denial of.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
But what I was getting to is that, you know, when we get beyond this kind of ideal, this postmodern ideal of equalizing the sexes and you know, it's the ideal of egalitarianism, which is all very positive and good, you know, taken to a pathological extreme. Then women discover this profound radiance and they become beautiful, right? And that's my experience. It doesn't matter what the woman looks like in terms of conventional. Right. She is beautiful and magnetic to my essence as a man. I fall in love with all of them.
Exactly. You feel devotion.
Devotion. Exactly. Exactly. But also what's remarkable in it from the women's side is there's this strength in the women that's not masculinized at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, how would you describe it? Describe it more for me. I want to hear what you've observed in that.
Yeah. Well, it feels like when women are fully giving the green light to all dimensions of who they are as a woman. I'll share with you an interesting thing that happened recently. So recently in our Sangha, our community, there's been an interesting development because most of the years, you know, I've been leading the men and Cynthia, she's been leading the women. And basically recently we occasionally do these retreats where we all come together. And on the last one we did, we really got into some topics around men and women and it was very, very raw and vulnerable. And what was groundbreaking about it was that women were starting to understand men in a way they never had, and the other way around, because of just what people were sharing. So what came out of that was I started to meet with the women. So I do a meeting on Zoom once a month, and it's me and about 30 women. And it's been incredible because, well, I'll just share with you what I was going to share. It's a good example of it. So in this particular call, I had shared with them, you know, the three-stage model. You know, we were talking about what women want through the lens of the three stages, you know. So the first stage is like, well, women want a man to buy her a bunch of flowers occasionally and carry her bag and that kind of thing, open the door for her. Stage two woman, she wants a man who's going to treat her as an equal and all that stuff, you know. And stage three, you know, she wants to be worshipped as an embodiment of the divine feminine, you know, and ravished open to God. You know? So we were talking about this, and then at the end of the first half of the session before the break, one of the women, she said, well, I can see I want all three. You know, I want to have a man who'll buy me flowers, occasionally, and hold the door open for me, and I want a man who treats me as an equal and respects my capabilities. And this woman is a very capable, creative woman. And I want a woman who's going to adore me as an embodiment of the divine feminine. And then she was like, oh, look at what an egomaniac I am. That's the way she put it out, right? And then we had a break. And while I was in the break, I was suddenly like, no, you're not an egomaniac. That's what you, not only what you want, that's what you deserve. Mm-hmm. I or we, as let's say stage three men, whatever that would be, we should be able to give it all. You know, so I came back on the call because that came up when I started the second session. I said, hey, Sasha, I was just thinking about what you said. And I actually think, I don't think it's egoic at all. I think, why shouldn't you be able to have it all? You know, and this was like a shockwave went through the whole group of the women, because it's like suddenly they all relaxed, you know, and they stopped censoring themselves in whichever way they were. And it had such a big impact that for me as a man, you know, and obviously they know me and trust me, but the fact that I would green light all of that, you know, and actually, instead of saying, well, yeah, of course there could be an egoic expression of all of those things, you know, but actually that your essential yearning to be loved, to be recognized, to be served in all those ways, it's authentic. You know, there's nothing wrong with any of it. And it had a huge impact on all of them. And and through this process of meeting them, you know, so it's like I'm having an impact on them, because obviously I represent mankind. And when they feel more, when they feel heard and seen, and also when I respond to them in ways that surprise them, or maybe they've never heard expressed by a man before, and also when I respond to them in ways that they wouldn't necessarily respond to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I'll recognize that divine feminine radiance in them, and I'll speak to it, and then the women wouldn't necessarily have recognized it in each other, and I'll bring it out, you know.
Yeah.
Because as a man, as you know, I'm so tuned into that, you know. But then also through this process, it's having a profound impact on me. It's very heart opening. It's very feeling them, you know, being together with a group of women who are leaning into this authentic feminine radiance. It's such a beautiful experience, and also it's been putting me also in touch with how not only we as men feel that devotion towards them, but also how their devotion, their feminine radiance can profoundly impact us, you know, but not in a way where we become equalized, you know, at all. It's just the way in which it intensifies this positive embodiment of a positive male pole.
You know? So I was going to ask you, do you talk to the men about what third stage kind of data orientation is for them?
We've listened to a lot of David Data, and so they're quite familiar. I do share aspects of his approach, and I, you know, broadly one way to language it that we very much resonate with, and I've used as a motif, is that strong spine and open heart, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I would say all the men of the collective are embodying to different degrees that third stage potential. And while there's some men who are more, have that masculine pole, you know, not more strong in their natural disposition, I would say the biggest challenge for most, because most of them are spiritual progressive guys, it's actually getting beyond that postmodern emasculation to whatever degree, you know, embodying an authentic masculine while standing in devotion and vulnerability. So this is where we're very much on the same page. It's very interesting. But I think, what's also interesting to me is not only what we're incubating as a collective of men, but how that interfaces with a collective of women who are engaged in the same work on their polarity, you know.
Yeah, so how do those communities, how do those two different groups interact at the retreats?
Well, so far, I mean, so far, as I said, we have a men's retreat every year and a women's retreat, and all of the men and women who are committed members and students, they all go on retreat. So, you know, usually it's for a week or whatever. Actually, this year we're going to do 10 days, the men. And in those retreats, it's very creative, and it's been very, just some very experimental stuff that we've explored. And then when we come together, so far, it's been more in the context of teachings, discussions, you know, inquiries. But those inquiries and discussions, and obviously a lot of the relationships we have, because many of the men and women are in sexual relationships also, the work that we do as men and as women informs all of that interaction. And I just think it's so healthy. You know, it's like, you know, it was interesting when I interviewed Jed Diamond the other day, because he's been in the same men's group for 43 years.
Wow.
And he's
incredible, isn't it?
And he's been married three times, but he's now in a relationship that's been going for 42 years, successful. Wow. And he said, when people ask me, well, how, you know, what's the main ingredient that has made it that 42-year marriage successful? He says, it's because I've been in a men's group for 43 years. And so I just think there's, you know, one of the things we really came together in is how it's just desperately needed for men to start to get together in some kind of deeper context. You know, just that fact alone, it's so rare. And, you know, women tend to be more relational. So, you know, as we know, women's groups are more common and all of that. But, you know, whatever modality it might be, I think just the fact of men getting together beyond just, you know, the usual banter down the pub football match, you know, it's so needed. And, but yeah, you know, what I'm really driving at is the value of men doing their work, let's say, mm-hmm. coming together as their own tribe, and women doing the same.
Yeah,
and that when that happens, it in terms of man-woman relationships, then, and especially sexual relationships, it takes so much pressure off the relationship. Because, well, a few different reasons. One is you're not looking for the woman, or the woman's not looking for the man to fulfill your every need in terms of relationship, you know, because you find so much when you're together with men, you know, when the women are together with women. And it's, and it also gives a vehicle for the men to, in just to relate this to what you're doing, to you know, to work through their issues, and also to find that positive, you know, that fundamentals let's call it spiritual self-confidence that we were just talking about, that a man has to know why he's here. He has to be on purpose, you know, that's foundational. And that's something men can really help each other do. You know, a woman can't really help you with that, or shouldn't be helping you with that, you know. So, I just think there's so much value to this kind of work that we're both engaged in. That's, you know, men, women, but as you say, it's in the context of relationship.
Well, you know, it's interesting because from the post-spiritual perspective, it's kind of like an incarnated spirituality.
Yeah.
When we get men and women really in their feminine instinct and masculine instinct, it's not like you're at Fox Hollow and you're talking about transcendental impersonal awakening. But this kind of awakening that we're talking about is actually very personal.
Yeah.
But it's shorn of the transcendental language.
Yeah.
Like when I help men become dominant, women become radiant. By the way, the typical nomenclature is dominant submissive, and I tweaked that. I changed it. Oh. I said dominant radiant. Oh. When we get women and men to be in that radiance and dominance respectively, it's actually a spiritual endeavor, spiritual act. Why? Because they really are incarnating at that third chakra, which is the one that is the most associated from, I think, of all.
I agree.
Especially because when you vilify masculinity, you throw off femininity too. And so the postmodern agenda, the cabal agenda, is to emasculate and eradicate masculinity. When you truly do that, and that's your agenda and it's planet wide, you fuck up femininity too. Because when you remove the masculine, then women have to become masculinized to compensate for the absence of that masculine energy outside. And then because masculinity has been vilified, then the men have to become more feminine in order to avoid the bullets.
Exactly.
And so when you get them healthy, when you get men back into their masculinity and women back into the femininity, and you reverse the inversion, as I call it, then that is actually profoundly spiritual, but you're not even talking about nirvana and non-duality. You're actually, it's what Wilbur would call more of like a translative endeavor superficially, but it's actually quite transformative. So the translative endeavor is to make the ego more comfortable in samsara. The transformative endeavor is to basically plug the ego into the divine so that it wakes up and realizes its supreme identity, and it's no longer that constricted, contracted, tiny little ego. That's right. Like the cosmic ego. I am that.
Right.
Okay. So, like, what we're doing is simultaneously, as the way I would frame it, using the translative, transformative thing, is we're working with the ego, but we're also doing transformative work as well. So we're doing translative with the ego, getting these men and women to understand their masculine and feminine, respectively. But it is transformative because when they are no longer dissociated from their masculinity as men and femininity as women, they can become really healthy.
Yeah.
Really healthy. So imagine like being at Fox Hollow and being a woman who's so caught up in the impersonal transcendental and the hyper masculine environment, and you're not wearing a dress. You wouldn't dream of wearing a dress. You're very masculinized. And then the men, okay, are all submitting to the hyper masculine figure of Andrew Cohen. So they're not actually able to really incarnate their own dominance and masculinity without him being right there, breathing over them all. Right. And so you, from this perspective, you can see why it would be dysfunctional, because like there was only one dominant man there. Like we, in the academy, we want all men to be dominant. There is a growth hierarchy there.
Yeah.
So I'm a senior coach. I'm coaching coaches. I'm coaching students. But it's a growth hierarchy. It's not a dominator hierarchy. So my coaching is the self-actualization of the men. I want every man in there to be dominant.
Yeah, that's exactly, that's exactly my approach as well. Natural hierarchy. And yeah, I often say, look, I don't want a bunch of followers, you know.
Yeah, I don't either. I really don't want that. I just don't get off on any of that guru disciple energy.
Yeah, and interestingly, you know, even Andrew would say the same. You know, he was an integral. You know, he was very close with Ken Wilber and all of that. But you know when some of his, I'm talking about the men, because the men thrived a lot more than the women did for this reason that we're exploring. But you know, he when a lot of those men, and I might have been included, you know, we were growing, you know, we were meeting him in many ways, you know, we were becoming self-actualized. And actually the reason I left when I did was because I knew I'd fundamentally learned everything I went to him and went there to learn, but I knew there was a cap on my capacity to self-actualize. You know, it was
absolutely, there's a ceiling.
You know, there was a ceiling, and you know, there were some people who really thrived in, because their gifts were valued. But you know, I had to leave, and you know, and then everything that's happened since is just demonstrated that it was the right thing to do. But yeah, you know, that just what you said about the dominant male, the one dominant male, that's also very interesting, because and this is why this whole matter of a growth hierarchy is something I really think is a leading edge to really authentically do it for real. It's quite something, because there's something very healthy about a strong verticality, you know.
Oh yeah.
And but to be doing that in a way where it's like, come on, you guys can meet me.
Exactly. That's the difference.
I have a core group of men. So there's a core group of men. There's five of them. So five of them, and they're explicitly core men, because they've demonstrated in terms of consistency and their capacity to lead. And you know, so my encouragement to them is for them to lead with me, to take responsibility. You know, so they.
That's right.
They're leading a lot of the smaller groups we have, because we also have weekly groups in smaller configurations, what we call holons. And so, yeah, I think that's so important, and especially for men, because men. I'm sure this is something you've come up against in your work, is the whole projection. You know, that gets put onto you as a leader, which is often to do with their father figure. You know, mm-hmm. So it's quite something to work with when, you know, maybe I'm in the position of being a strong leader, and maybe at times challenging someone very strongly, but not to want to support them putting me in some kind of authoritarian big daddy position. You know,
yeah.
As a kind of placeholder, you know, it's like, okay, so I'm kicking your ass now, you know, take it, you know, okay, now you responded, now just relate to me as a brother.
Exactly. You know,
I'm your teacher, but don't stay in this kind of disposition that I'm the top dog and, you know, you're the submissive male. And it's just really a delicate process to work with these kind of dynamics, where all the men are mutually being empowered, but there's no flatlining, you know. There's a healthy kind of male competition also, you know. It's like, yeah, so if somebody's really demonstrating leadership, look so-and-so, look at how much they've changed, you know. What about you? You know, you've been involved 1 year longer. What's going on, you know? So there's that positive kind of friction you can bring to bear, which men respond to, you know, when they're up for something, you know, because it's in our nature. but to do that in a way that's not prerogative and
that's not what? Can you say it again?
It's not limiting, you know.
Okay.
Putting people in boxes, yeah, because this is also something else that happened at Enlightened Next, where people would, for what, you know, for better or worse, they'd end up getting labeled, you know, and then, you know, stuck in their own box, basically, you know.
Right.
And I think with this kind of work, it's so, because as we know, a lot of our patterning is very intractable, you know, it's always repeating itself, but you always have to keep that context of like, look, anything's possible anytime. Anyone can snap out of their patterning, you know. So you always have to hold that door open of like, look, we don't know who you are. We're not putting you in a box, you know, even though you've been driving us crazy for 3 years, you know. So anyway, I'm
not because I can relate.
Just rambling a bit here, but I'm sure you can relate with a lot of the delicacy of being in the kind of positions we're in. And
it's when I was practicing at this Zen monastery, I remember one of the abbot at the time. He was like explaining to the Sangha what it was like to be there at the head of the Zendo with a few hundred people looking at him, all of them projecting onto him what they thought about him and how they idolized him or whatever, and to be on the receiving end of all that. And it's so interesting because when I showed up on Facebook and started just sharing this stuff, I did notice that people would do that, but I would just be like, you know what? I'm just here to share what I see. That's it. And I found in the academy, it's just like there's so much work to do that I didn't even have time to, I don't know, bask in any kind of adulation. I'm just too damn absorbed in what needs to be done.
I can totally relate.
It doesn't really do anything for me, although I don't object to it. It's just like if someone wants to show me some great love, I'll take it because that's like sunshine. But it's like we got to keep this train on time, and we're really serious about what we're doing here. Because so much of the fulfillment comes through the actual coaching and work itself, and then anything that people give is kind of like in the form of compliments or whatever's, it's like receiving some nice love. But it's not where it's like this guru who just kind of feeds off adulation. Right, because for me that's all actually really swampy. Like I honestly, to be honest with you, I don't want everybody's attention just entering me all the time. I want us to be focused on the work.
Yeah.
I don't want to be penetrated by all this adulation, attention, praise, compliments. If it happens, it happens. But really, hey guys, instead of focusing on what you think about me, let's focus on what we're doing here.
Exactly. That's why I call it the men's collective.
Yeah. So we were just discussing how moral relativism emasculates men because they cannot feel truth in their bodies.
Right.
And that this postmodernism, generally speaking, that relativizes morality, relativizes truth, is not some arbitrary development in human civilization. It is a deliberate co-opting of human freedom.
Right.
Because when you relativize truth, men cannot lead. You lead based on the sense of truth inside you, a sense of morality inside you. When those two things are taken offline and relativized, men become emasculated. They have nothing to lead if they have no moral compass.
Exactly.
All truth is relative.
Right. Yeah, this is, I'm totally with you. But it's really radical. I mean, I hope a day is going to come where, you know, the leading edge of cultural development, let's call it integral, actually realizes that the postmodern green meme is not actually a natural outgrowth of cultural higher development. Obviously, some aspects of it are, we could say. But
So we're kind of talking about the pathological iteration of the green level of environment in green level of development, and also kind of conflating it with postmodernism. There are some distinctions, and it's been a while since I've studied those distinctions. But what we are looking at as what could be called an aberration,
mm-hmm.
like steering humanity down a certain path of relativism, of identity politics. And these have actually accelerated into wokeism now.
Yeah.
So 20 years ago, you could see the seeds of what is now wokeism, and it's full blown.
Yeah.
And it's the normalization of insane perspectives. Okay, that like men can have periods, and if you don't believe that, you are an oppressor.
Yeah, and you can't define what a man or a woman is if you're not a biologist.
Exactly. So that's where we've seen insanity normalized, and people not knowing what to do, because part of them knows that this is fucking insane, and that men who get gender reassignment surgery competing against women and swimming and beating them is wrong. That's fucked up. But how do you call that out if there's no such thing as truth?
Exactly.
Right? Exactly. If there's no such thing as biological essentialism, and that's all arbitrary social construct. Well, actually, here's what I say. The idea that everything is a social construct is itself a social construct.
Right.
Okay. There are social constructs that are anchored in biology, which is how they arose. So when we talk about gender roles, that's actually connected to biology of male and female physiology. And that's how those gender roles evolved. Mm-hmm. So the gender role that is described as a social construct is actually rooted in biological essentialism.
Right.
Now, there are social constructs that aren't rooted in biological essentialism. And that social construct might be like, basically, sorry to say this, transgenderism. Like, that's not rooted. Okay, I don't have any prejudice against trans people, but I will call out the trans agenda.
Exactly.
These people are, I still love them, okay? And they'll really be prejudiced against me for saying this, but there is an agenda to confound masculine and feminine.
Exactly.
Which is part of the agenda to systemically emasculate men. And so when you make gender fluid and people non-binary and transgender and whatever, that's all an agenda of those people behind the scenes. Exactly. Okay. And there is a point to this, and it is to divide and conquer the human race.
Right.
Okay.
To completely destroy and disenchant the human spirit.
Oh yeah. So notice this contradiction, like the binary exclusion of binary. So that's so binary, masculine and feminine. That's wrong. Actually, what that is a performative contradiction. The person is being binary against binary. You're saying binary is evil. Well, that's a binary perspective.
Right. That's the performative contradiction, as Ken would put it.
Exactly. You contradict yourself in the very utterance.
We have to be tolerant of all views as long as you don't disagree with mine.
Yeah. Exactly. If you're not tolerant of all views, then I am intolerant of you.
Right. Madness. Yeah.
It is madness.
It's systemic cultural madness in the name of care for the whole. This is the great manipulation, that this all has to be done so that there's, you know, the greatest circle of compassion for all beings and all of that. This is how they manipulate, especially the progressive.
It's part of this whole pumping everybody with fear and hijacking the amygdala.
Yeah.
So they do that with scamdemics. Okay. They do that with identity politics. Like so they'll say to these people, you know, the LGBTQ crowd, that unless they're really promoting and over promoting their agenda, then they're going to be squashed and oppressed, be marginalized. Right. And so then that identity becomes weaponized, and that identity is fighting against people who are not part of that identity. It's because those LGBTQ people feel like they're going to be wiped out if they don't continually vocalize their concerns. Right. They don't want to be oppressed, but then that gets weaponized and now there's a conflict. And then in order to ensure these LGBTQ people are taken care of and not destroyed, we now have to change everything about our culture to accommodate this minor faction. And in fact, what happens is now they're colonizing.
Yeah.
Listen, if LGBTQ people want to have their own things, that's great. I don't have a problem with that. But they can't force me to start talking and doing certain things to accommodate them. So if I want to say straight and they say, no, you can't say that, you must say cisgender, then all of a sudden what's happened is I'm now being colonized.
Exactly.
Something in the margin, right? Exactly. And I won't tolerate it. And I don't give a fuck what anybody says to me about it. It's like, I'm against racism, right? I can't stand racism. But there are people who say I now must be anti-racist. So it's not enough just to be against racism. I must be now going out everywhere and actively calling it out everywhere. I must be on the hunt. That's what anti-racism is. I must be on the hunt against racism. So now this tiny faction is now basically puppeteering my consciousness and saying, I got to go out and do these certain things, believe these certain things, or I'm a bad person.
Right. Yeah, it's madness. We all have to take the knee.
That's right. And so you and I are old enough to actually remember life before this insanity. I mean, it's been insane for as long as we've been alive, because this agenda has been in play for, some say thousands of years, and I agree with that. But it's like the agenda to basically invert reality. Yeah. Why do these people behind the scenes, I'm avoiding the C word because I don't know if that'll activate the censors. Why are these people behind the scenes need to invert reality and turn things upside down? Why? Because when we are most confused, we are the easiest to control.
Yeah, exactly.
So if I'm out of touch with my body because you've got everything fucked up in my mind, well, it's very easy to just lead me wherever you want me to go.
Exactly.
Why? Because I'm divided and conquered against myself.
Yeah.
If I'm a man not in touch with my masculine instinct and I'm gaslighting myself, I am divided and conquered in myself.
Yeah.
And you get to control me and divide and conquer me from everybody else.
Exactly.
And meanwhile, while I'm fighting myself and I'm fighting them, I sure as hell am not seeing you.
Right. That's very well put. I think that's a perfect description of the agenda and the madness that we're in the midst of. I'm an optimist at heart. I think a new day is on the way.
I do too. I actually do. You know, what these people have discovered is the greatest resource is not gold or diamonds or whatever. It's an enslaved human being. So we ourselves are the resources.
Right.
But the reason why we're so valuable as resources is because of the genius that each of us is capable of.
Exactly.
Right. I view, well, I'm going to say the C word, cabal ontology. There's a cabal ontology on our head, sucking the kundalini out of us, as it were, sucking the vital life force. Once that cabal ontology is removed, every human being has that vital life force, that lightning, that kundalini, all of us, that can then move toward self-actualization and genius in a way that was not possible when the cabal ontology was stuck on our head like a facehugger from Alien.
Yeah.
And that's where we're going now. Yeah. Because here's the thing, Peter, to sustain inversion requires tremendous energy. Okay. And the reason it works is because we all believe it. So they've got to invert reality from the moment you exit the womb to the moment you die. But the reason it works is because we're all similarly hypnotized by this inversion propaganda. And the way I've said it is that imagine there are 100 people. 50 are awake, 50 are asleep. Okay. If you awaken 25, you go to 75 awake, 25 asleep. Then that 75 exert a tremendous influence on that remaining 25. They lose 12. Well, that's 87 awake and 13 asleep. Those 87 now work on that 13, and it becomes exponential.
Got it.
And that energy that is required to sustain the inversion is dwindling because it's totally dependent upon us believing it. That's it.
Yeah, more and more people are not believing it. And just to say though, just to put this conversation in a context, I think it's so important that people like yourself, you know, let's say spiritual leaders, integral leaders, leaders in the field of cultural and personal development, have the guts to speak out about this.
Yeah.
Because I see that as a big part of the problem.
Yeah.
You know, there's, you have all these relatively awakened people, you know, some may be very awakened, you know, who are doing all kinds of, you know, evolutionary work in different fields, but they're all in the matrix, right, and they don't know it. No. And I know, you know, I do know one or two that know more than that, but they don't have the guts to speak out about it. Why? Well, it's not going to be very good for business. Yeah. You know, they're going to be vilified. They're going to be attacked. They're going to be labeled a conspiracy theorist, all the rest of it, you know. But anyway, it's just great to speak with you and just resonate on this level too, because it's an astonishing thing to me that it's actually some of the more apparently awakened integral thinkers and minds who are the most resistant to even looking at the empirical evidence. It's just it's astonishing to me. There's such a fear, you know, that you can have people who've been very courageous in terms of confronting the lies of their own mind, you know, and been willing to confront the ego, you know, in a very serious way, that, and in context that most spiritual seekers wouldn't go anywhere near it, right? But then when it comes to questioning the fucking news, the reportage not of their own mind, they're terrified. They don't even want to look, you know. It's that threatens this fundamental worldview.
Yeah. And he also demonstrates.
We all know why. Well, if I look into that and I find out, oh, maybe that's not true. It all started for me with 9/11. That's where it all started. Well, then it's like cui bono, you know.
Yeah.
And then you go down the rabbit hole. And it's like, oh my God, you know. And then you realize, like I have over these years, we've been lied to about just about everything.
Everything.
Everything. Everything.
And the reason is, humans make great sheep. So the way I frame it is, animals, metal cages, humans, mental cages.
Yeah.
So just as you want to control a baby calf when it's born on the farm and you have them in their cage or really the fence, that calf has to be born into a fence, into a pasture that's fenced.
Yeah.
The human has to be born into a mental cage.
Exactly.
And can't possibly conceive of reality out of it. So it's like really conspiracism is, for me, the way I frame it, is a natural outgrowth of spiritual awakening. Because spiritual awakening is about waking up to the illusions and delusions of your own mind. Well, every time the freaking news comes into your mind, that's a delusion, and it's now in your mind. So why wouldn't you get to the truth of it?
Exactly. I'm preaching to the choir here, man.
All right, brother. Well, listen, we got to do this again. I love chatting with you tonight.
Fantastic to meet you and speak to you. Yeah, let's
absolutely. I love resonating with you on all these themes. I feel very blessed and thankful.
Yeah, thank you. Me too. It's great to connect.
So thank you very much for listening. That's it for today. If you would like to find out more about my book, The Fire of the Heart, you can go to thefireoftheheart.com, where you can also download 4 free chapters. If you'd like to find out more about the Awaken Life Project, then go to awakenlifeproject.org or our Awaken Life Project Facebook page, where you can find out all about our ashram, extended spiritual community, retreats and other events, and our adventures living off-grid in the mountains of Portugal. So keep on keeping on until next time, and as they say in Portugal, até já.